Matthew Dickman was born in 1975 in Portland, Oregon. He was raised by his mother in the suburb of Lentz. After studying at the University of Oregon, he earned an MFA from the University of Texas at Austin's Michener Center. His first full-length collection, All-American Poem, won the 2008 American Poetry Review Honickman First Book Prize in Poetry. He is also the author of two chapbooks, and his second collection has just come out with W.W. Norton, and it's called Mayakovsky's Revolver. Matthew Dickman, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, Matthew.
So I have in my hand a copy of your latest book, Mayakovsky's Revolver. It is put out by W.W. Norton. Congratulations. You went from the most incredible independent poetry publisher, Copper Canyon, to one of the most incredible poetry trade presses, Norton. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Tell us about a little bit about the title of this.
Well, you know, the first time I ever heard the name Mayakovsky was through Frank O'Hara's poem for Mayakovsky. And then that got me interested in who that person might be. And so I picked up some of Mayakovsky's work in translation and was reading it. But then moved on to reading other things. And then years and years later, this title came out of a dream that I had when I was working on some poems that came into the book.
Cool. And I love the premise of the poem that was it on eBay or some auction website that they were auctioning off his revolver?
Yeah.
And then from there, it goes on to imagine many things. And I think that's what I really love about your poetry. It could start anywhere, go anywhere, and somehow it miraculously comes back.
Yeah, all by luck.
Well, or talent.
Yeah. So when you sit down to write a poem, I imagine one of my favorite quotes is by Flannery O'Connor. She says, if you're not surprised what happens in your work, the reader's not going to be surprised. I imagine you're surprised all the time.
I am surprised all the time. It wasn't always like that 100 years ago when I sat down to write a poem. It was only after I felt like I had the poem in my mind and was walking around with it and had kind of a strict plan for what I was going to write. And then as I've gotten older, that's changed. So now when I sit down, and I'm sure this shows in my work, I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen.
And you sound like you're so old. You're still a very young man. This is only your second book. You got a long time to go.
This is true. Hopefully, yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Who started writing poetry first, you or your brother?
Well, according to my brother, I wrote the first poem. In eighth grade, I wrote a poem and turned it in for some assignment. And the teacher loved it. And so he, during class, hushed up the classroom and said, you know, I'm going to read a poem that Matthew wrote. And so he read it out loud. But then he said this thing. He said, of course, you know, this isn't exactly a poem because it doesn't rhyme.
Where did he graduate? That's right. You know, speaking of rhyming, one of the things about your poetry is I could open up, you know, both your books and see, okay, yeah, this is shaped like a Matthew Dickman poem. You don't see any couplets. You don't see tercets. You don't see
quatrains.
The lines are exactly what the lines need to be as opposed to trying to fit into a particular form. When you were a younger poet, did you try to write more formal structures?
Yeah, I did. I mean, not too formal, but some of my earlier poems are, you know, in stanzas, they're in couplets, they're stanza breaks, and, you know, it's not a very romantic story, but what really happened were two things. One, I was constantly frustrated with figuring out, like, how a stanza is made and why some poems of mine might go into couplets and some not.
Right.
And so I woke up one morning and really just woke up and thought, wait a minute. I live in the United States of America. I don't have to do stanzas if I don't want to do stanzas. And then also the type of poem I started writing, this kind of more meditative poem, just didn't feel organically like it would fit with stanza breaks.
Do you write freehand?
I do both. I write freehand, and then sometimes I'll wake up one morning and just start working on a poem straight onto the computer.
how did you come about studying poetry? Or did you, did you study it formally?
I did study it formally a little bit. I did do an MFA program eventually. You know, I started writing it in high school, partly because this girl that I really liked, who was a grade ahead of me, liked poetry. And so I started writing some of it, but sort of an important moment for me in high school was when a mentor of mine, Ernie Cachado, a teacher, he gave me a postcard that on the front had a picture of all of these beatnik poets standing together in front of City Lights bookstore. So it was all these men. It was a great photo.
I know that photo.
But I looked at it, and it was the photo was actually startling for me, because in the neighborhood I grew up in, like a group of men standing on the corner, they weren't there to make art or to do anything that was sort of humane.
Right. You grew up in a very working class kind of a neighborhood that was kind of tough.
It was tough. Yeah, at the time it was. You know, we had gang violence in the form of skinheads and bikers. And it was working class. A lot of the fathers were absent. A lot of alcoholism. And this picture of these men standing on a street corner in San Francisco who obviously loved each other but were still masculine really sort of blew my mind in high school. And it told me that I could sign a different contract than the contract that was sort of being passed around the neighborhood to young boys, you know.
We're talking to Matthew Dickman, whose new book of poems, Mayakovsky's Revolver, just came out with W.W. Norton. I wanted to ask you about that section about the brother, the lost brother. It was incredibly moving. And I'm thinking about that first poem, or that poem from your first book about grief, that purple monster. And it seems that this is kind of an extended poem about grief. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. Well, the grief poem in the first book, an All-American poem, and also in that same book, there's a poem called Trouble, which cites a great many different people's suicide. And that poem was the first poem that my older brother sort of appeared. At the time, it was too intimate or too difficult to sort of write through or have it be inspiration for writing. And inspiration meaning, for me, like compulsion, you know, absolute compulsion, not inspiration like how the ocean's inspiring or walks on the beach. And so this central part of the new book, which is 13 elegies all making up this section called Notes Past My Brother on the Occasion of His Funeral, came out of a couple things. I mean, one, it came out of just an absolute impulse to reach out to this older brother who I loved and who is now gone. And it was also a way for me to engage in the mystery, not of just his death and his suicide, but of the sort of incompleteness of myself and the incompleteness of the world in a way.
When you were growing up and you're starting to become a poet in the neighborhood that you grew up in, did it make you feel more a part of the neighborhood, or did it make you feel like someone apart of the neighborhood?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, sort of looking inside, you know, myself right now, I would say that it did a couple things. I mean, one, it made me feel more intimate with the neighborhood, because when I wrote about the neighborhood and when I was writing these early poems, they were reactions, of course, to my life and the world around me. So it created sort of an intimate bridge between myself and the place that I lived. And then at the same time, it was something that I kept secret. If I was, like, skating with my skate punk friends, I wasn't going to start singing about how I was writing poetry at home late at night. Which is maybe too bad. I wish I had been braver at the time.
You could have called them song lyrics.
True, yeah, that's true. But also, you know, there was poetry, you know, that was given to me in high school, which was not that exciting, like Byron and stuff. But in the neighborhood, there was a different kind of poetry, too. I mean, we listened to hip-hop music, and we listened to punk music. And both those genres of music, rap sort of more obviously, is all about poetry.
Right,
but,
right.
but I would argue that, that bands like the Circle Jerks and Minor Threat, that they carried a kind of lyric poetry with them as well.
I want to go back to something. You saw that photo, and it gave you an opportunity to yeah. option to kind of rewrite your own manhood, you know, that you could be a man in a different way. And is that tied up to poetry as well? Maybe that was a secret because boys don't write poetry. This is not what people from this neighborhood do. And maybe, you know, you were trying to find your way, and so it was a secret.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And then I think also because I was raised without a father, as many of my friends were, I was sort of always, you know, especially back then, always looking for a dad. Mm-hmm. And so some of the first poets that I read were sort of, in a way, adopted father figures, and super masculine at, you know, the first poets I read, Bukowski and Philip Levine. And actually, I read Bukowski over and over again, partly because his poems reminded me of the few fathers I knew in the neighborhood. and then I remember reading Philip Levine's What Work Is and thinking, like, here's a poet who's talking about a kind of masculinity, but it doesn't have the weakness that Bukowski has. It doesn't have the giving in to violence or alcohol or the abuse of women and that sort of thing. Mm.
And how did you make the leap then to start reading a poet like Frank O'Hara?
That came much later. That came after reading a bunch of other poets. And I came to Frank O'Hara and his group, like Kenneth Koch and James Schuyler, because a mentor of mine, we were sitting down and having lunch, and it was the first time he had ever read any of my poems, and we were having a little meeting about them. And he asked me who I was reading. And I said, oh, well, I'm reading, Lucille Clifton and Szechuan Miłosz. And at the time, I was also reading this poet named Dara Weir. And he looked at me and he said, no, you're not. I said, well, yeah. I don't know, actually. I mean, those are the poets I'm reading right now. And he asked if I had ever read Frank O'Hara or Kenneth Koch or anyone. And I said, no, but I heard they were really good. And this was after All-American Poem was almost all the way finished.
Mm.
And he's like, look, these people are members of your tribe. Like, you need to go. They're your cousins. You need to go read them.
Oh, that's
so,
nice.
So I did.
Where are you at? Where are you living now? You're in Portland?
I'm in Portland, Oregon, yeah.
Do you teach there, or are you lucky enough to write full-time?
No, I have several jobs. I mean, my last sort of punch-in, punch-out job was at Whole Foods here in Portland. But
We call it Whole Paychecks because it's so expensive.
Whole Paycheck, yeah, it's true. But I haven't worked for them for about 2 years now, and so I have a few different jobs. I am the poetry editor for Tin House Magazine and Books. And in fact, we just started a thing that I think is really interesting, which is Tin House Books has started a collaboration with a small indie press called Octopus Books to put out a book of poems a year as an experiment of collaboration between two small presses. And the first book is just coming out, I think, next month by this poet, Brandon Shimoda. It's a beautiful book of poems called Portuguese. But yeah, I work there, and then I also work with the Vermont College of Fine Arts Low Res MFA program.
Mm.
I take about 3 or 4 students every once in a while. And then I write, I do some freelance writing for an advertising firm here in Portland.
Oh, you know, we have an online MFA here, and Brian Turner is going to be teaching a workshop with us next semester. Maybe you could do it sometime. You would be awesome. But anyway, we won't recruit you right now. But I did want to.
Brian's amazing.
Oh,
Brian's
he's great. Yeah. I'm from Fresno, and so I know all the Fresno people, all the Fresno poets, Brian and Philip. And I actually lived in Philip Levine's house for a while. It's awesome.
Wow.
But I wanted to mention a fun fact about Matthew Dickman and his brother. I don't think that all of our listeners realize that they have seen you before, whether they don't know it, but they have seen you before because you appeared as a really incredibly memorable character in the movie Minority Report. Can you talk about that?
It's true. Sure. It was a wonderful, strange experience. The short story of it is that my twin brother and I were involved in acting in high school and and in college early on, mm-hmm. and then stopped acting and were sort of consumed by writing. And so years later, we got a phone call from our mother, and someone had called the house. This is long after we moved out, of course, asking to meet us and perhaps have us audition for this role for a Spielberg film. And we thought it was a joke, but then it turned out not to be a joke. And one thing led to another, and they were looking to cast only in L.A. and New York, but all the twins that they were looking at were like these, you know, handsome built models. And, you know, they didn't want that. So they looked at us and they thought, well, this is more of what we're looking for. And but it was great. It was a great experience. You know, we lived in a hotel in L.A. for about a month. And everyone was so kind. And actually, Steven Spielberg was very, very kind to us. And we would have conversations with him about poetry. And so
you and your brother were two of the three Oracles, I think the character's name were, right?
Yeah, we were called Precogs.
Yes. Precogs, that's so, it. Yes, yeah. And you floated in water the entire movie. How did that feel?
Awesome. It's the best job ever. I mean, we got paid to be in a hot tub, you know. It was and just shaped.
You and your brother must be awfully close.
My twin brother and I are very, very close. Yeah, very close.
And you don't compete with each other, do you?
We don't, no. Not in the way you might think. I mean, early on, we both have been really lucky with an early, you know, poetry career or, you know, the secular life of publishing. We've been really lucky. But early on, you know, our work became so different from each other that, you know, if Michael won an award or got a poem published in the same place that I tried to, you know, there's like a little jealousy, but I was mainly proud. And if you look at our work, it's so varied and so different that I assume someone who is really interested in Michael's work may like mine, but it may not be their cup of tea and vice versa.
We were talking to Michael Wiegers, the editor at Copper Canyon Press, about a year or two ago, and he was talking about you and your brother. He says that he discovered your poetry almost at the same time and was amazed at how good you guys were.
Oh, what a sweet man. Yeah, that's so nice of him to say.
And a year later, I picked up your book, and he was right.
Thank you.
So what is next for you? I mean, obviously you need to promote this book and get, you know, it's just brand new. And so you'll probably be doing a lot of readings.
So yeah, a bunch of different readings, different places, and then also just working on other projects as well. I'm working on a draft of a children's picture book as well as like new poems. And
you know, that's a great field, children's books. I write children's books and I love to do it. And I love reading to them. I think that you'd be great with them.
In the past, I worked at a daycare, and then I worked as a private nanny.
Really?
Kids are some of the most, they are the most intelligent human beings on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're so honest, and their responses are so refreshing sometimes. And where they're uncensored. I encourage you to get into that field. You know, it's very, very rewarding.
They're so wise. I was in a room once with three friends of mine, and one of my friends, his daughter was there, who at the time I think she was around like 6 years old, and all these guys were talking about being stressed out with work and all these things and what they did because of stress, which is mainly like, you know, maybe going to a bar or, you know, listening to loud music. And I turned to her and I asked her, you know, when you get like upset or stressed out, what do you do? And she thought about it for a moment and she said, well, I go into my room, I shut the door and I dance.
That's sweet. That is really sweet.
Isn't it sweet? But then the next time I got really stressed out and freaked out about some stuff in my life, that's what I did. No music. I just danced around my apartment, and it's the best advice. I felt so much better about being alive afterwards.
You know, back in the days when kids said amazing things, they would put them in Reader's Digest. Now you see them on Facebook a lot.
Right. So, yeah, the new Reader's Digest is Facebook.
We're talking to Matthew Dickman here on Words on a Wire. Matthew, we always ask, if our guest is a poet, we always ask our guest to pick a poem and read it for us, because we always have a segment called Poem of the Week. So, Matthew, can you pick a poem and read our Poem of the Week?
Sure. Do you have one you want to hear?
I think Daniel does.
How about Canopic Jars?
Sure.
Matthew, I have to tell you, I'm going to out Daniel.
Uh-oh.
He's your biggest fan.
Wait, maybe instead.
Oh, he's changing his mind again.
Yeah, ooh. Maybe gas station, because I love Dorianne Locke so much as well.
And
I
was sure. Written to I'd love her. To read that.
Yeah, let's read that one. This is dedicated to Dorianne Locke.
Yeah, this is for Dorianne. There's no telling what the night will bring but the moon. That's a no-brainer. A no-brainer moon sitting there at its desk, wishing it was outside on the playground with little Rebecca Steinberg, her hair around her shoulders like streamers on New Year's Eve. The night is going to be a very long night, and I am walking into it with my sleeves rolled up, my cap on tight, all my worthwhileness stuffed into my back pocket like a wallet full of transcendental credit. The subterranean elegance of shadows and the moon like the inside of a jawbreaker after all the color has been licked off. All that sweet dye and sugar, layer by layer, until only the soul of the thing is left, the hard center that will choke you to death if you're not careful, which I wasn't the summer I turned 14. Anton and I had cornered a younger kid behind a 7-Eleven who was fat and walking with his little sister. We screamed at him, "Say you're fat, say it, say you're fat." And he did. He said it, he cried and said it, and whatever strength he had as an older brother, as someone his sister looked up to from behind her big blue eyes, caught fire between us and went out like a match. Later that night, I was walking past the Chevron station on 92nd and Foster, next to the 92nd Street Club dancers, and this guy came out swinging a gun, his face like an apartment that no one had lived in for years, the gun pointing just above my head when it went off, the moon exploding and the wind picking up all the pieces like a mother picking up all the dirty clothes in a house full of children who never listen to a word she says.
That was beautiful, Matthew. Yeah.
Thank you, Matthew, for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me. It was a real joy.
And we look forward to having your brother on a future show. But
that's perfect.
Tell him you were here first.